Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning into episode 203 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crowe with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on prn.fm or subscribe to the podcast using iTunes or another podcast program. You can listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and just follow the instructions. Remember that you will be responsible if there are any long-distance charges. I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you, so send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show and what you like about it. If you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. If you'd like to sponsor this show, please contact me. You can make a one-time donation via PayPal using the email david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com or a monthly donation at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. And that's PATREON. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you're gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to other of your ideas. If you'd like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of on just about any of the topics I've covered in my shows, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. I appreciate you commenting. I really appreciate you suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thank you for listening and for recommending this show to your friends. And now for some feedback. Lawrence wrote about the Jacobs Degenga show, Jacobs' book, Medical Nihilism. He writes, "At one time I believed in HIV and AIDS, then I learned it wasn't true. Then I thought they were targeting gay men. All this was done to harm gay men. Then I learned about vaccines for babies. Wow, gay men and babies. Then I learned about breast cancer in women. So, gay men, babies, and women. Then hypertension and cholesterol. The elderly, men, prostate cancer. I'm seeing the same thing over and over again for everyone, just different so-called diseases. AIDS is not a new thing created to harm gay men. It's just following the status quo. It's the same old thing that we've been doing and are doing with the whole population. I'm working with a relative on research for medications. This is what I found. 7 drugs. 5 of the 7 have black box warnings. She's taking 5 drugs for hypertension, while taking 3 drugs that cause hypertension and 4 drugs that cause hypotension. She's taking 1 drug for angina pectoris while taking 3 others that cause angina pectoris. Taking 1 drug to prevent acute myocardial infarction while taking 4 that can cause it. She's taking 4 drugs that can cause cardiac failure, which means heart failure and death. She's taking 5 drugs that can cause hepatitis and hepatic failure, acute liver failure, which means death. She's taking 4 drugs that can cause impaired renal function or failure, which can mean diabetes, dialysis, and then death. And she's taking 2 drugs that cause bradycardia, which slows the heart. It's a slow death." Ray, on episode 201, Dick Avlin talking about PSA. "The show was almost unlistenable because of all the background noise while your guest was speaking, while you were crystal clear. I don't know if he was rattling papers outdoors in the wind or it was a bad connection. Please address such disturbances in future shows by asking what the problem is. If it's a bad connection, dial a second time." Yes, Ray, apologies for that. I don't know what the problem was, but it was in the phone line. It was nothing that he did and nothing on my system. As you could tell, my connection was good. I probably in the future facing the same thing. I probably would try a different phone line, Skype. There's lots of options. Donald, about the same show, said, "I'm going to buy his book. It was one of your best shows." Marla wrote from New Zealand, "I think you do an excellent job bringing up alternative views and ideas, and you are always on subject and do not ramble. I appreciate that. I think I may have suggested this guest to you for your previous podcast, How Positive Are You? It would be wonderful if you could get former South African President Thabo Mbeki to come onto your show, even if just for a pre-recorded interview. I've always been astonished at how a man of his stature and importance was turned into a pariah, and largely because of his criticism of the AIDS consensus. I know there are other issues related to him, such as some supposed corruption, but I suspect much of this is also manufactured by his critics. And best wishes for a happy Christmas and New Year. Well, Marla, all the best wishes to you for the holiday season. And I have tried to contact Thabo Mbeki again. I've tried through his foundation once before and got no response. I'm afraid that even Thabo Mbeki thinks the subject of HIV and AIDS is toxic and may not want to stick his head up out of the trench again. But if I hear from him, I will certainly be very happy to interview him. We haven't had an episode on the subject of the justice system for a while, but when I saw a review of the book The End of Policing by Alex Vitale, I knew that I had to interview him. I can't really think of a world without the police, but his provocative title did make me think about exactly why we need them. As a middle-class white man, I've had very few interactions with the police, a few speeding tickets, a vandalized car, a couple of petty thefts. But I also know that there's a dark side to the police. The war on drugs, completely futile, on sex work and sex workers, on immigrants, and police shootings with, until recently at least, almost total impunity. So, let's talk about it. Alex Vitale is a professor of sociology and coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Project at Brooklyn College. He has spent the last 25 years writing about policing and consults with both police departments and human rights organizations internationally. He also serves on the New York State Advisory Committee of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. He's the author of City of Disorder, How the Quality of Life Campaign Transformed New York Politics, and The End of Policing. His academic writings on policing have appeared in Policing and Society, Police Practice and Research, Mobilization, and Contemporary Sociology. He's a frequent essayist whose writings have appeared in the New York Daily News, the New York Times, The Nation, Vice News, USA Today, etc. It was his book, provocatively titled The End of Policing, published by Verso in September 2018, that caused me to want to interview him. So welcome to the show, Professor Vitale.
Thank you.
Maybe these days it would be normal to start with police shootings of black men, but one of the things I learned from Ferguson that seems to underlie all of this is that policing in poor communities appears to be money-driven harassment. People are arrested and fined based on minor offenses. Driving without insurance, driving without a license, which are probably much more common among the poor, a broken taillight, things like that. So what can you say on policing as a fundraising enterprise for poor cities?
Well, I think we do need to be careful about overstating this. There is a tendency to limit a kind of progressive analysis to following the money. And it's certainly true that in Ferguson there were some corrupt policing practices that were, using a criminal justice system as fundraisers. But I don't think that this really explains what's going on, for instance, in big city policing, which is where we have, hugely problematic impacts from policing. While some cities have had various kinds of quota systems, these were really driven or designed to drive individual officer productivity rather than generating income. And in most cases, the police department isn't really implicated with the amount of money that's raised by courts and fines, et cetera, because that money doesn't flow through their budget. It goes to the city budget. And in a place like New York or Los Angeles, it's a lot of money, but it, in comparison to the overall city budget, it's not substantial.
Okay, so
where it does exist is deeply problematic, and it not only shifts resources from the very poorest people in the community, it also can result in totally unnecessary incarcerations, suspended licenses that then lead to arrests, et cetera. So I think more broadly, we want to challenge the use by police of a whole host of kind of traffic enforcement mechanisms that rely on very expensive and punitive systems of fines that target largely the poorest folks.
And I mean, maybe this isn't directly related, but I have observed living in North America for a long time that we have lousy public transportation, and so the poor need a car just in order to survive in many cases. And of course, it's very hard to pay for all the expenses.
This is especially true in rural and suburban areas where transit links are notoriously inadequate, especially in terms of servicing poor people who, in fact, disproportionately need those services.
Right. So I've heard a lot about broken windows policing, which seems to be how minorities come into contact with police much more frequently than, say, middle class white people in cities. So how does that work, and what was it intended to do, and what did it actually do?
Well, the broken windows theory is definitely a big factor driving what I call the larger problem of over-policing. And this is a deeply conservative hypothesis that was laid out not in an academic journal or book, but in a magazine article, and never really been backed up by any independent testing, any peer-reviewed research. And it basically says that if we allow too much individual freedom and unregulated public behavior, that this will lead to severe criminal activity, and that the best way to deal with this is to use the police as a tool of enforcing moral standards of, you know, appropriate public behavior. And this leads to millions of punitive contacts between police and the public over very minor and sometimes even non-criminal behaviors. And there's just no evidence that this enforcement does anything to reduce serious crime.
And I mean, can you give us some examples? Can you give some examples of some of the trivialities that could be criminalized?
Sure. Well, here in New York, you know, for many years, the leading things that would get you arrested were, being in the park after dark, failure to pay the $2.75 transit fare, drinking an alcoholic beverage in a public space. These are things that may be, you know, technical violations of the law, but are hardly major criminal activities, and yet it has driven hundreds of thousands of people into the criminal justice system in ways that have been incredibly disruptive to their everyday lives and has generated a huge amount of resentment by the public that's been targeted in these quality of life enforcement efforts.
Yeah, and again, if you have economic means, then if you want to drink, you can drink at home, in your backyard or inside your house, and nobody will bother you. If you're poor and don't have much living space, then a park seems like a good place to drink or enjoy.
And often what we see is that this stuff is actually used to target the most vulnerable people, homeless folk, street youth, people who really have very few alternatives. So that instead of, for instance, building public bathrooms for our massive homeless population, we criminalize urinating in public.
Yes, I saw something in Paris where they wanted to build urinals that were discreet, but then somebody said that's not equitable for women. But of course, it's not possible to do the same thing for women because of simple anatomy. So because
of... You could do something, and I think the real objection was not the gender equity. I mean, Amsterdam has these, other cities mm-hmm. have experimented with them. I think there was just a backlash by very conservative members of the public who find the idea of public urination so distasteful. And so they would rather have people criminalized than to provide some kind of ameliorative infrastructure for them.
Right, and I guess, again, the economic disparity is if you have money, you go into a coffee shop and buy a coffee and use the washroom. Whereas if you're poor, there may not be any coffee shops in your area, and if you come in looking grubby, you might get kicked out.
Well, and in the situation in Paris, it was really the issue they were trying to address was often nighttime behavior.
Mm-hmm.
When many places were closed and young people who'd been out drinking were forced to urinate in public because there literally was no place for them to go. And so this seemed like a good solution, but people on moralistic grounds have opposed it.
Right. Okay, well, let's talk about shootings by police. How much more likely are you to be shot by police in America if you're a black man versus a white man or woman based on the differences in populations?
I believe the latest research I saw was about 18 times more likely. Now,
and
Go ahead.
And is this is the total shootings by police? Is there a big disparity between the number of people shot by police in America per capita, say, and other modern, industrialized countries like Europe, for example?
Oh yeah, there's a huge difference. And one of the things, in addition to the racial disparities, I think it's incredibly important to point out that between a third and a half of those people who are killed in the U.S. by police have a mental health problem, and that there's a real question of why the police were ever called for in the first place in these situations.
Well, this is one of the points you make in your book, is that when there's a problem in America, and it's not just America, I think this occurs a lot in other countries, it tends to be, why don't we have the police handle that problem? And I mean, your book, you seem to be saying from the title that that's never the right thing to do. I guess we can have that discussion a bit later. But it does appear that mental health issues are being dealt with by police because somebody's making a disturbance in a public place, and who do you call? There's really nobody else to call, right, who can deal with the situation in the present day.
You know, there are two problems. One is that we have such a lack of baseline community-based mental health care that more and more things become a crisis. So that if we had this community-based care, we wouldn't have so many emergency calls. And then when we do have emergency calls, instead of sending a trained mental health worker, we send armed police. And that contributes to an expectation that if someone wants to commit suicide, that they can call 911 and armed police will come, and if the person does something remotely threatening, they can count on the police killing them. And then the police say, see, we have to have a police response because so many of these people are threatening. Yeah, but this is all because of all the failures that have come before.
Right. There was a case in Toronto where there was a young man suffering some kind of mental health crisis, who I believe had a knife, But at the time he was shot, he was alone on a streetcar. So the only thing he could do at that point was property damage, unless he decided to charge out of the streetcar. But they shot him inside the police car, inside the streetcar, pardon me, as if they couldn't think of any other way to get him to calm down or, you know, to somehow separate him from the knife without having to kill him.
Yeah, this is the kind of threat neutralization approach to policing, which is widespread in the U.S. and obviously exists in Canada to some degree.
Yes.
That is really not about going the extra mile to preserve life, but to operate from a kind of warrior stance that says, as soon as I see any justification for the use of deadly force, I'm going to go ahead and use it.
You probably heard about the policeman who was fired because he didn't kill somebody who was holding a gun that he knew was unloaded. And the man with the gun said, shoot me, and, you know, asked to be shot by the police, and the policeman refused, knowing that it was a case of suicide. But when his colleagues came, they shot him right away. And then they fired the policeman who hadn't fired his gun.
Yes, well, obviously that's very troubling, and that is consistent with this kind of, you know, really toxic conservative thin blue line kind of mentality that runs through policing, that really views the world as divided between good and bad people, and that the police need to be this essentially authoritarian force to police that line between good and bad. It deeply misunderstands, I think, the complexity of human nature and overestimates the value of these kinds of violent authoritarian interventions.
One interesting thing about some of the police killings are that black and minority policemen seem to show similar behaviors. So, for example, in the Baltimore case where a man was essentially shaken to death in the back of a police van, it wasn't a shooting, obviously, the policemen driving the van were black. Some people said, well, you can't say police are racist because this was black on black violence. How does the culture of the policing affect minorities who are employed by the police?
Well, there's absolutely no evidence, despite numerous studies, showing that the behavior of non-white officers is any substantially different than the behavior of white officers. They're all embedded in an institution that sends a very strong message about what the job is. And so arrest rates, use of force rates, complaints from the public are fairly consistent across race. The racism is not really at the level of individual bias among officers, even though we have such bias and we find it all the time. We just found some emails in St. Louis, and, you know, it's a common occurrence to find racist language and messages among police. But the real problems of race are much deeper than that. And this is why I really object to things like implicit bias training, because it assumes, A, that the bias is at the individual level, and B, that it's implicit. So both of these, I think, are inaccurate. And what we need to do is we need to ask the bigger question of why it is that problems in poor and non-white communities are overwhelmingly turned over to the police to deal with, while problems in wealthy areas get dealt with in other ways. And so when we rely on criminalization as our primary mechanism for solving community problems, we're going to exacerbate racial inequality. And that's exactly what we've seen over the last 40 years, is this expansion in the use of policing to address every problem in communities of color in poor areas.
And another striking thing about the American police services is just how many they are. I was trying to think, in Canada, for example, we have a national police force, we have a couple of provincial police forces, and some large cities, most large cities have their own police force, but that's about it. But in America, it seems like every small town, every county has a police force. And does this have an impact on how policing is done?
Well, we have between 17 and 18,000 individual police departments in the United States at the local, county, state, and federal level, as well as, you know, hybrids of all of the above. And they all have different procedures, different training, different hiring processes, and this makes any kind of oversight or creating national standards extremely difficult. People have looked to the U.S. Justice Department to, you know, oversee policing, but at the best, you know, they come in, they take on a particular department, they try to get some improvements in that department, but the other six departments next door are basically under no obligation to abide by what's been, you know, done in this other department. And then we find a huge amount of backsliding and ineffectiveness in these federal interventions in the first place. So really, it's a huge problem. Local politics play a tremendous role in determining police priorities, and it's often, you know, deeply problematic.
A couple other things about that is, one is it was obviously much easier for a policeman who gets in trouble, you know, an unwarranted shooting of a civilian or something like that, to move to another police department. And also, does it mean that a lot of police don't live in the area they're policing?
So in terms of moving around, this is an issue. Some people are working on it. There needs to be some kind of a national database of officers who've been fired for cause and some system for, you know, looking at past complaints against these officers. What was the second issue?
How many officers, are a lot of police officers in the United States policing an area that they don't live in? Like, I understand in New York.
Oh, okay, right, the residency. So that's a mixed question. You know, increasingly, police do live in the jurisdictions that they police. There are some concerns in the big cities about assigning patrol officers to neighborhoods that they grew up in, because there is a history of that leading to low-level corruption.
Okay.
Because what happens when your best friend from high school is the local drug dealer and you're the cop on the beat? You know, so in New York, for instance, about a majority of officers now are from the five boroughs, but they still make an effort not to assign those officers to the neighborhoods that they live in.
That's interesting. Well, let's talk about interactions between the police, the U.S. police, and the military. The U.S. has a law called Posse Comitatus, which says that the military can't do policing, but it doesn't seem to be stopping the police from becoming more and more militarized.
Well, and it hasn't even stopped the military from engaging in policing. We've seen a lot of erosion of posse comitatus. The war on drugs has been a huge driver of all of these processes, and also border policing. So now the military are involved in drug interdiction work along our borders, as well as some immigration-related border control work. And this has led to some shootings and deaths, and there's almost no basis for accountability in these kinds of situations. And it really is worsening the problems of policing. said that, there's a great new book by Nicole Siegel at Indiana called called Violence Work that points out that distinctions between civil and military and public and private policing are never as black and white as we want to think that they are or as that we're led to believe that they are, that policing has always had militaristic elements to it, just as armies have always had policing qualities. And mm-hmm. so this can change in degree, but I think the problems of policing in the U.S. are not because they have too many bits of military equipment. I think the problem runs much deeper. And once you tell the police to have a war on drugs and a war on crime and a war on terrorism and a war on gangs and a war on disorder, you're going to get deeply problematic policing, whether or not they have tanks and body armor and stuff like that.
Well, maybe we can, your book goes into a lot of the wars that America is having on, you listed some of them. I listed the war on sex work, the war on drugs, the war on gangs, the war on illegal immigrants. So what would happen if we removed the police, say, from the war on sex work? I guess that would mean that we would decriminalize prostitution. Would that result in the decline and fall of the American empire?
I don't think so. You know, sex work has been fully decriminalized in New Zealand, and civilization has not come unglued as a result, nor has it led to an increase in sex work. In fact, it's resulted in a lot of very positive things. The lives of sex workers are improved. The risks of violence and the spread of disease are diminished. These sex workers can have the ability to organize for better wages and working conditions, improve safety, etc. And I think we need to take a kind of harm reduction approach that says that anyone who's talking about abolishing sex work is totally naive and living in a fantasy world.
Mm-hmm.
Sex work has always existed. And what we need to do is quit trying to pretend we can eliminate it through state action and instead try to work to improve the lives of people engaged in that work and also improve the lives of marginal workers more broadly so that people who are currently pressured or coerced or drawn through lack of options into that kind of work will have other opportunities.
Right, and if sex work was regulated, it would probably be much easier to deal with people prostituting minors, for example, or shipping in immigrants from another country in kind of a quasi-slavery situation to act as prostitutes. If it was
nothing
legal,
is a perfect... Right, nothing is a perfect fix, but if you bring sex work out of the shadows and it's no longer under the control of organized crime, then it's going to really reduce the prevalence of those kinds of practices. Because why would you go to some sketchy underground place when you can go to the corner place and know what you're getting into?
Right.
Now, there will still be people who will want these forbidden activities, harmful practices. And, you know, if we create a kind of environment where there's good enforcement of labor laws and more openness about this stuff, it'll be harder to keep that stuff a secret.
I remember... Maybe next we can talk about the war on drugs, but I remember somebody talking about in Amsterdam where they have these marijuana cafes saying that if you're running a marijuana cafe and you let minors in, you're going to lose your license. So you've now sort of privatized the desire to keep minors out because you don't want to lose your license, as opposed to completely completely criminalizing it, in which case the drug dealer, whatever he does, is illegal. So he doesn't care if he's selling to a 12-year-old or an 80-year-old. If you pay the money, he'll sell it to anybody.
Also, that's all true. And also, if we bring it out of the open, there's more opportunity to utilize informal systems of social control. Basically, you know, commonly held standards about appropriate public behavior. And when we turn things over to the state, we really undermine those informal social controls.
Right. I guess if we talk about alcohol, that's been a big, over maybe the last 30 years, a big drive to stop people drinking and driving. And that's been mostly, although, you know, there's been police stopping people and checking, you know, doing breathalyzers, but a lot of it has been through social pressure. Bars have encouraged people to have a designated driver, and they'll call a taxi and that kind of thing. It's not been a completely police-driven program.
That's right.
I assume that you've followed countries like Portugal that have decriminalized drugs, and things seem to be going okay in Portugal. Do you have any comments on places which have decriminalized drugs?
Yeah, well, I think this is exactly the direction we need to be going in. We're just caught in this totally asinine approach to drugs that is predicated on this idea among much of the public that we need the state to be this mechanism of sending a message to our kids that drugs are wrong. And I, for one, have kids and don't want the police having anything to do with telling my kids what's right and wrong. That's my job. And the police involvement in the war on drugs is entirely negative. We've had a war on drugs in the U.S. for over 40 years, and anybody can get any kind of drugs they want, anytime
right.
they want them. It's had absolutely no positive effect. We've locked up literally millions of young people on drug charges and have nothing positive to show for it, and that's in large part because I don't think it was ever really about public health or public safety. It was about a cynical politic of appealing to white voters in the wake of the civil rights era as a way of signaling that we were going to get tough on blacks, and we have, you know, the data from inside the Nixon administration that shows that that's exactly what they were thinking, and we just have to get police out of the drug business. We need schemes of legalization, deregulation in some decriminalization in some cases, and just do well-thought-out harm reduction and public education strategies instead.
It sort of relates to things like stop and frisk. If you do stop and frisk in poor areas, black minority areas, and you don't do stop and frisk in wealthy white areas, then you're going to find more drugs on black people, which reinforces the notion that you need the war on drugs to stop black people from taking drugs.
That's right, and we have data that shows that this is true, that the enforcement practices are overwhelmingly racially biased, and this is true for traffic stops that are often not about real traffic infractions. They're fishing expeditions looking for drugs. We call them pretextual stops. And this should just end.
Okay, so gangs are not something that most people can see a positive side to. President Trump has talked about, what is it, MS-13 and the horrible people there are. Is the war, what's wrong with the war on gangs? It doesn't seem like there's anything positive about gangs.
There's a deep confusion about what gangs are. And often gangs are whatever people in power think need to be targeted. And it's almost entirely, you know, young people of color. So that when young people of color act in antisocial ways, it gets labeled gangs, and then the message is that these are, you know, sociopathic super predators that will only respond to, you know, harsh punitive measures. In reality, the gang situation and youth violence and delinquency more broadly are much more complicated and nuanced than that, and gang suppression policing has never been shown to be effective. In fact, there are many people who argue that it actually hardens gang identity and makes gangs more violent, because then the focus of the gang is not just socialization and mutual protection. It becomes a war on the cops, a war with the cops, you know, this constant battling with the cops. And this really makes these young people and their collective activities more dangerous. People have tried gang injunctions and databases. This stuff just doesn't work, and it's deeply discriminatory.
Right. I mean, gangs will morph when they're under pressure, and so things like violence becomes a tool to avoid arrest. So if you suspect one of your members is talking to the police, you're just going to kill them.
Well, I wouldn't say that so much as I would say that it's about identity formation. So mm-hmm. young people are searching for their place in the world, and gangs are a way for them to manage that, because their home life often is not appealing or may actually be dangerous and destructive. And so they're trying to form some identity. And left to their own devices, they will group up to hang out together,
mm-hmm.
play ball, walk to school together. If there's pressure from other young people, they will also get into fights to defend their territory. But when the police start harassing them, the identity of the gang becomes, we stand up to the cops because they're mistreating us. And then the people who become more popular and powerful within these groupings are the ones who are the most effective at standing up to the cops, being tough. It used to be the kid who could throw a good party, who had access to a good DJ turntable, you know. These were the popular kids, but now it becomes about who wants to fight with the cops, who wants to act tough, and it can just really spiral in a bad direction from there.
Other countries that have less armed police, what difference does that make to the life of people in those countries? If police in America are all armed, but in some countries like the UK, they're not. I mean, what difference does this make?
Well, it means that a lot fewer people get killed. But, of course, it's complicated by the fact that, you know, the U.S. is a very violent place. Our whole history is one of violence from top to bottom. Our government is a huge user and exporter of violence. To have these politicians wag their fingers at young people and say, you know, violence never solved anything, while bombing half a dozen countries around the world simultaneously is a gross hypocrisy, and should be pointed out as such. So violence is cooked into the American way of life, and we have to address that violence at all levels, not just wagging our fingers at kids who get into fistfights after school.
And it seems like it's a bipartisan issue. Everybody's talking about George Bush Sr., who just died, and his approach to the war on drugs and things like that. But Bill Clinton, who was a Democrat, also upped the war on drugs and comments on super predators, things like that. I mean, is there a change in politics now, or have the Democrats at least decided that more and more policing is not a good thing?
I don't think so. I mean, there is some recalibration going on, and you do see some Democratic officials you know, at the local level, pushing back against some of the worst of this. And we see marijuana legalization expanding increasingly, mm-hmm. which is mm-hmm. great. But we have a long way to go. I mean, the politics of the Clinton's 94 crime bill remain very powerful and very destructive and largely bipartisan. And we continue across the U.S. to treat community problems as problems that can only respond to policing. And as long as we do that, policing is going to be this deeply corrosive force in these communities.
So what, I mean, were you serious when you wrote the title of your book, The End of Policing? Do you think a country could survive with no policing? Even if you admit that there's over-policing, is this tongue-in-cheek, or do you really think that we could get rid of the police and still have a civilization?
Well, you know, policing is a fairly recent invention. It's less than 200 years old. So we have plenty of world civilization without police as we understand it today. The title has a kind of double meaning. Part of it is end of policing in the sense of means and ends. Like, what is the end purpose of policing? What do we really want it to accomplish? But the other is definitely signaling that for so much of what police do today, the solution is not, you know, training and a better attitude. It's just quit using them. And I think where we draw the line on that is an empirical question. I think a vast majority of what police do today is counterproductive and should be eliminated and replaced with community-based strategies that treat people with as much dignity and respect as possible and really get to the root causes of the problems that we have. And if we were serious about doing that, then let's see what's left at the end of that where we still need armed police.
Yes. I mean, I guess the first thing to get rid of is things like prohibition of marijuana, which if it has any harms, and that could be a long argument, they're much less than the war on marijuana has caused.
For sure.
There are definitely drugs that are very corrosive, but on the other hand, we sort of have this, we're handing out prescriptions for opioids still, when those are the most dangerous drug, and we have this kind of schizophrenia. Well, that's a legal drug, and that's illegal, but often drugs have gone from legal to illegal once they became too big of a problem. But making them illegal hasn't made them go away.
That's right.
Nor has it made, it's created a number of problems, such as gang violence related to the drug war, plus people don't have any quality control over what they're ingesting. And I think a lot of deaths from opioids have been because people didn't realize how potent the drug was, because if drug companies can do one thing, that is quality control on the chemicals that they sell.
Yeah, if we make heroin legal, possibly available through a doctor's prescription, we'll see a plummeting of overdoses. We'll see a reduction in usage. We'll see a reduction in secondary infections from the sharing of needles and other unsafe practices. And it will just be a huge public health improvement.
And I think we can,
Go ahead.
Yeah, I think we can see that with alcohol and cigarettes, where there's been a lot of social pressure to use them less or more responsibly. There's been a big decline in cigarette smoking, but it was done while cigarette smoking was completely legal. What if cigarettes had been abolished? Right? Would we actually have more people smoking cigarettes now than under the environment of making it legal, but applying social pressure to tell people about the health effects and to you know, prevent people from smoking in public places, things like that?
Well, we don't, you know, it's not clear if we'd have more or less, maybe neither, but we would have more dangerous practices associated with, and we will turn the whole market over to criminal enterprise.
Right.
And that comes with all kinds of problematic stuff, too.
Well, a lot of people getting killed because of gang wars or violence between the police and the gangs, well, I guess there's so many things that happen when criminal enterprises take over. So, getting towards the end of our discussion, what gives you some hope that the future of policing will improve, and that some of the, at least maybe not the end of policing, but the end of some bad policing, bad police practices, over-policing, policing when not necessary, things like that?
I think that we have to get rid of the wars. We have to get rid of all these wars on disorder and gangs and drugs, and then we can talk about how to make what's left as humane as possible. But I think until we get the police out of the business of doing a huge amount of what they're doing, these efforts at retraining, sensitivity, even accountability are just doomed to failure.
And as long as city budgets are dramatically skewed towards policing, I mean, if a policeman leaves the police force, there may be limited options for an equivalent paying job.
Well, that's what I've argued, is that we need to offer people job transfers, and if we were really investing in communities, creating youth intervention programs and real social work settings and employment opportunities, there would be jobs for people who currently work in policing and corrections. And most of those people would much rather be coaching an after-school football team than beating up prisoners in a lockup.
I would hope so. thank you very much for joining me today. I found your book very interesting. It was a provocative title, but you know, when you think about it, there's so many things that are policed that don't need to be, and so often it only makes situations worse.
So well, thanks for having me on, and people can follow me on Twitter at A Vitale.
At A Vitale. I will include that in the show notes, and I will send you a link to the podcast when it's up next week.
Great.
Thank you very much, Alex. Goodbye.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Speaking of the justice system, or often the injustice system, one case that's getting a bit of attention, and it should be, is that of Cyntoia Brown, who was 16 when she killed a 43-year-old man who had taken her to his house for sex. She said she was scared for her life. The courts ruled otherwise. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that life sentences for juveniles are illegal, but the Tennessee Supreme Court has ruled that her 60-year sentence is not illegal because she can get parole after 51 years. Obviously, if she was genuinely in fear for her life, the conviction was wrong. But even assuming that she murdered someone for no justified reason, a 60-year sentence for a juvenile is vastly excessive. The fact that she was a poor black woman working in the sex trade, presumably as an underage prostitute, doesn't seem to have helped. Imagine a daughter of wealthy parents in the same situation, and just how many avenues the lawyers would have explored to eliminate or minimize the charges. There is still hope in her case, as the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals is still considering it, and it's possible that a pardon could be issued by the governor. But it seems that courts are more likely to support the harsh justice system that is meted out to people who can't afford expensive lawyers. They seem to think that people would lose trust in the justice system if it overturned convictions more frequently. Maybe that's true. More directly related to policing is video of New York Police Department officers trying to tear away, well, successfully tearing away a one-year-old from a mother who committed the crime of sitting on a floor in a Brooklyn food stamp office. She was also sent to jail, so now her one-year-old is doubly traumatized. Even if the woman had been obnoxious, had disobeyed orders, the force exhibited by police was outrageous, just like the 60-year sentence given to Cyntoia Brown. These examples are both in the U.S., which has some of the worst excesses of policing and justice. But it's not just there. In Canada, the Ontario Human Rights Commission released a report on December the 10th, 2018, that showed, despite black people making up under 9% of Toronto's population, between 2013 and 2017, they represented 28% of police use of force cases, 36% of police shootings, and 70% of police shootings that resulted in the death of a civilian. Thank you for listening to episode 203 of The Infectious Myth. It seems like every culture and religion has a holiday around this time of the year, so I wish you happiness with whatever you're celebrating, time with friends or family or doing something fun, or maybe all three. Maybe I'll go skiing to have some fun myself and deal with all the extra food I consume at this time of the year. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.